Good evening, one and all. A Wednesday, I know, and it's October, and still in the 70s. I don't know. I mean, we had 90s the other weekend, still in the 70s, and I think the weekend they're still talking about 70s here in Connecticut. But I am here, and so is my guest. Now, my guest has written a book about his life, and it's very interesting because somebody who basically reads and reads and reads has done all their life, and then they lose their sight. What happens then? Well, my guest, he sort of discovered a whole new world in, well, we'll talk about it. Let's introduce him first. My guest on the show today, I have the one and only David Fouché. Hi, David. How you doing?
Pretty good. Thank you.
Okay, as I said, your book, which is called Across Two Summers, basically is a year in the life of a blind bibliophile, but it goes back to sort of, you know, growing up and family and restaurants. It's like a whole life story in a way.
Right. It starts out actually across to November. It covers that year from November 16th, 2013, and ends on November 15th, 2014. It includes my thoughts during that year. As you said, restaurants I've eaten at and enjoyed, many books that I've read, book reviews that I've submitted to Library Journal, and occasionally a bit of trivia.
Okay. Now, obviously, a year in your life, but your life is, as you said, is sort of, you know, the stuff you remember, members and stuff during that year. You sort of grew up, we weren't blind from birth, you know, this is something that happened to you later on in life. So, you know, you were an avid reader, obviously, from what you said. I think it's like over 200 books are quoted or reviewed or something like that in the book. But, you know, to remember all the TV programs and the bits of music and stuff like that you have. So even though it is that snapshot of a year in your life, there are, you know, quite a few remembrances in it.
Exactly. I was actually born with some vision problems, but I was still able to see enough to watch TV and, you know, to remember colors, obviously, to see what people look like. And as I got older, in my early teens, I started losing that vision because I was diagnosed with glaucoma, which I understand is a bit unusual. But as you were saying, TV shows, in the book, I do mention on several occasions, especially when I had learned of the death of a particular actor, such as the, I believe it was the professor in Gilligan's Island, and I just mentioned how I used to watch that when I was a child. It's sort of a silly show, but it was popular in the 1970s with people, with young people.
And you, I mean, you know, it didn't stop you because you got 2 degrees, didn't you?
I did get a degree in English in the 1980s and returned to college in the later 1990s to get a Master of Library Information Science. So I did definitely get the 2 degrees. It was quite an adventure. It was very different in the 1990s as opposed to the 1980s. Because there had been changes in technology. In the 1980s, there were talking computers. Apple IIe comes to mind, but I didn't actually have one. I basically went to college and used an electric typewriter and a four-track low-speed tape player so I could record classes and braille out my lecture notes. And then if I needed to write a paper, I would type it. By the late 1990s, I had a talking computer. By then, it was an IBM clone running Windows. And I also had a Braille light, which is a tiny Braille note-taking device that would be best described as a sort of Braille keyboard with a very small memory. But I could use it to take notes in class and also store my notes and retrieve them later to review them. So it was definitely interesting, both times, and both times, as I said, were very different.
Right. And, I mean, Your love of reading that's always been there. You then, I think a friend encouraged you, didn't he, to do an audio blog.
Right. My audio blog, which I did from approximately May 9th, 2004 to early March of 2009, was basically the idea of David Rothman. David Rothman is a journalist. He might be best known for the book The Solomon Scandals, though he also, that's a fictional account of some a developer in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s. He also wrote Networld, which dealt with computer technology in the 1990s.
Right. Yep.
And he maintains a website, telereed.org. Anyway, I happened to know of him because in the mid-90s I caught him on the Jim Bohannon show and emailed, and he emailed back. We got to be friends. We even met once in D.C. in the mid-90s when I attended a collection development meeting at the National Library Service section for the blind and physically handicapped. To make a long story short, in 2004, he suggested I do an audio blog. They were starting to catch on then, and I don't think many blind people had done one yet, so I dove in. The blog consisted of, again, some book reviews, but it also consisted of my thoughts on different things that were happening. It also consisted of some interviews with people. I remember I did an interview with best-selling author Michael Farquhar, who also has a connection to the Washington Post. He wrote or writes nonfiction about sort of historical things that happened in America. And also I interviewed a professor at Boston University who had written a book about the 1970s. I also interviewed a lady at a local university here in Louisiana who was an opera buff. I remember also including tiny, tiny bits of recorded material on several books I had read because I wanted people to hear just a bit of what the narration sounded like. I remember comparing a British narrator with an African-American narrator. They were so different, but they were both so very good.
Right, and that actually has become, you know, you followed up with that at the audiobook side, didn't you? Because you actually review audiobooks now.
Again, that has to do with David Rothman. He came up with that idea in late 2005. He thought perhaps I should try to become a book reviewer as a way of getting my name out because I hadn't been as successful as I wanted in the library world of finding work. I'd had some health challenges and still do, and he suggested I consider reviewing books. And we decided the best thing might be to consider audio books because they were the format I was most familiar with. And he contacted Library Journal, and then they started talking to me, and we worked it out that I could review audiobooks. And as of this interview, I have done about 80 for them over about a decade.
Good. Now, obviously, you know, these days, many, many books come out in audio versions. So are you finding, you know, there's plenty for you to sort of listen to these?
There are definitely too many books, too little time, as one of my library school friends like to say. In fact, I just reviewed a couple of weeks ago the new Ken Follett, A Column of Fire. It's the third book in his Kingsbridge series. It's set in the second half of the 16th century and deals with the religious turmoil between the Protestant and Catholics of Britain. Well, it wouldn't have been Great Britain yet. It would have been England. They weren't going to be Great Britain, I think, until 1707, but it was England.
Something like that, yep.
And also France. I liked Follett's long historical stuff. The shorter suspense stuff, often set in World War II, are good as well, but suspense makes me kind of nervous. I don't read that at night because I tend to get excited and don't want to go to bed. So I like the longer, slower, more stately historic fiction.
Historic stuff. Is there, as you listen to these audiobooks, is there something that you really wish people would understand? Is there sort of mistakes that people make? Either it's too quick or sometimes it's hard to understand. Is there anything you've sort of picked up along the way?
My biggest concern, and I would have to distinguish between those books that are recorded commercially in audio format and those audiobooks that were recorded for the National Library Service, which is part of the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress National Library Service narrators were incredibly good. They rarely, if ever, mispronounce something. I find that commercial audiobooks, the ones that are put out by people like Books on Tape or Recorded Books or Macmillan or Hachette Audio, sometimes a narrator mispronounces something. It seems to happen a bit more than it ever happened with the Library of Congress National Library Service for the Blind, but that's not my biggest fuss. What I don't like about an audiobook, and it happens more with the commercial stuff, they want to say the book is performed by, and then it can get very narrated, very dramatic. I like an audiobook to be read, to have a suggestion of narration in the sense that a bit of drama in the sense that the narrator might change his or her voice slightly for male characters versus female characters. You don't need to have a different voice for every character. You can over dramatize the book to me. Now, some people like that. I prefer a less ornate style because the book, to me, if it's written well, is going to convey a lot of that for you anyway. You just don't need as much. Now, what I have liked with commercial fiction is if a book is told in several points of view, with those points of view shifting between characters, the commercial producers tend to assign a different narrator to each character when the characters change, in the sense that if part one is told from the point of view of, say, Elizabeth I, part two is told from the point of view of her fictional, her fictional maid, and part three is told from the point of view of one of her companions, Robert Dudley, it would use a male voice. See, that I like. NLS doesn't do that quite as much. So there is something good to be said for either of the two commercial versus the National Library Service. Either one is good. Now, you couldn't get National Library Service books. They're only available to those persons who are blind or physically unable to hold a book or to read. But with so many audiobooks commercially now, you really won't miss that because there is so many things now. You can download from Audible. You can borrow CDs from your library. There just seems to be an endless array of books now. It seems like the world has finally discovered audiobooks in such a big
exactly,
way.
Exactly. You're very true. I mean, so many people, I hear, I'm going on a journey. I've got a couple of good audiobooks for the car, and they do that, a lot of people these days. And I know I used to, when I was back in England, we had an audio library, like a work audio library, like how to improve your this, that, and the other. And yeah, I used to play it. I had like a 40-minute drive, and I used to sort of, take a cassette from the library and play it, going and coming from and going to work in the morning. It's that little bit extra bit. And what finally made you write Across Two Novembers?
As I discuss in my introduction, I have long wanted to write something, be it fiction, nonfiction, a mystery, short stories, and it just never worked out. Then in early November of 2013, a friend of mine, Dr. Catherine Schneider, a blind psychologist who had recently retired a couple of years previous, was just finishing her book, Occupying Aging. It discussed a year in her life, and it was how she managed life in her Wisconsin college town as both a woman who was retiring and a blind person. So I reviewed it for Goodreads. I mentioned that her mix of the sublime and the quotidian served as an excellent introduction to how an older blind woman, might navigate her town and her life. And I thought, well, if she can write a journal, it was entries every day that you would sit every day and write a paragraph or two, sort of writing in little bits and pieces, and then that you would have a great whole at the end, a great piece of work.
Right.
I thought that that would be something I might be able to do as well. So I dove in right then on November 16th because I figured better not to even put it off, because if I had waited till January 1st, which is often the more traditional date, beginning date for a journal, I might not want to do it, or I might talk myself out of it. So I jumped in.
Right. Right, when you were fully ready. Great.
That's why the title is Across Two Novembers. It also suggests slightly the Newbery Award-winning book from 1965 called Across Five Aprils. It's a book for young people. It's a fictional account of a young person's managing, I think he manages a farm in Texas during the Civil War. Now, my book obviously has nothing to do with that, but I liked the idea of a cross, so I used Across Two Novembers.
And what sort of response have you had from the book?
I have done several interviews with several different media outlets. Recently, I did a review on KRVS, which is our local NPR affiliate associated with the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. I was on September 13th for about a half hour. We did that. I had to work for it, but I managed to get several reviews from Amazon. I've looked at over 1,100 reviewer profiles on Amazon while I listened to them, and sent out about 250 or 300 query emails, and got about 5 reviews that way. I think that's harder to do now. Too many people are asking these Amazon reviewers for reviews now. A gentleman in the top 100 told me, in fact, a British guy told me he would be unable to do it. He was so backed up. Apparently, some of these people get 50 or more email queries
wow.
a day for books or just anything, books and also products, health, you know, beauty aids, games, clothes, you name it, and they're getting it. So I was grateful to get any of these reviewers' attention. So I did that. I also was able to get to appear on a show. Jim Brown, our former Secretary of State, has a Sunday morning radio call-in show, and I was able to appear there. I also was able to get several reviews from several published authors. Those reviews actually appear on the book cover itself, and they're also reproduced on the website where you can find the book. And I'm also hoping to line up a couple of other shows.
I know food and cooking and that is something you're very keen on. Do you include that sort of part in your book?
The book does discuss restaurants and different food that I like. In fact, when I was trying to decide on a title, I thought about calling it Jambalaya, A Year in the Life of a Blind Bibliophile,
right.
But decided if I had called it either Jambalaya, because of its many different parts, jambalaya being the rice dish with the bits of pork or chicken and different seasoning that's so popular down here, I thought if I called it that, people would think I'd written a cookbook, which I certainly hadn't. But I do mention restaurants that I've enjoyed in Lafayette, such as a Thai restaurant, also a barbecue place. Unfortunately, that place closed since my book came out, but it was very good. And I also enjoyed just a local corner store that has plate lunches, and a friend from New York is utterly fascinated by the concept of a plate lunch, so I'll explain it for your listeners if they're not familiar with it. A plate lunch is basically what you would probably call in Britain a meat and two veg. What happens is
right.
you have a choice between maybe 3 main dishes. Say maybe the other day they had chicken fettuccine, they had smothered beef over rice, and you could have gotten red beans and sausage. The sides were of which you could pick 2: green salad, candied yams, mustard greens, and black eyed peas. So you picked your main one and you picked 2 of those sides, and there you go. And it costs about $5.98 with tax. So my friend was utterly fascinated by that concept. A lot of restaurants here, well, I should say, it's actually not just restaurants, but corner stores and even some gas stations have a plate lunch. Some don't have as many choices. You might know that on Monday, store X might have red beans and sausage. On Tuesday, they might have smothered chicken. On Wednesday, it might right. be meatball stew. But it was just an interesting idea that people developed here, and that apparently not everywhere does. But we are a food obsessed culture in South Louisiana. Everything revolves around food.
Yes, I it's one of the places I want to get to down there before I leave. One of the other things I know you sort of like collecting, not factoids, but you know, interesting things. Do you manage to sort of bring those into your book as well?
Yes,
like anecdotes and bit. Yeah.
For instance, I mentioned the book briefly to describe the book. It's divided into 13 chapters. They each go with a month. It has to be 13 instead of 12 because the two Novembers are split. So you have November twice. In each chapter, at the end of the chapter, I mentioned a couple of books I had read in that month that I thought were outstanding. One was by Robin Roberts, the Good Morning America host. And at the end of that, I have a lagniappe section in each chapter. That's a term from down here that refers to just a little bit extra. Storekeepers used to throw in a little bit extra, maybe some hard candy, to thank their customers for shopping there. Perhaps the family would come for their monthly supplies of rice or coffee or flour and sugar, and the storekeeper might throw in a couple of sticks of hard candy for the children. Anyway, my lagniappe section includes a couple of bits from the blog, because the blog, though an audio blog, did have some text portion I was able to keep and I could use. That would stand alone and make sense in many of the blog entries, not all. So I weeded and picked just a couple from every month. And I also added books through the years. And to make a long story short, the way I related, for instance, December's book, I mentioned a book by Diane Ackerman. It was The Zookeeper's Wife. And at the end of a mention of that book, I mentioned, did you know that according, and I gave the book and the author, giraffes have a neck that contains 7 vertebrae, each is 10 inches long. In my January chapter, I mentioned you perhaps would not want to drink the entire contents of a Nebuchadnezzar bottle of champagne, because that would be the equivalent of something like 15 liters of champagne. You'd fill. And
yeah.
So I did try to work them in where I could, because good. I also mentioned trying out for Jeopardy in my book. I didn't actually get to go that year to actually go to the live audition. I took the online test, but I had other commitments, and it just didn't work out, because when you try to take the Jeopardy online test, you just never know when they'll call you back, and you don't know when auditions are going to be. I've gone
twice. Indeed, yeah.
One year the auditions were, in fact, it was the day of the royal wedding. It was April 29th, 2011. I was in Orlando, and this time, if I had been able to go, it would have been in mid-July. So you never know when they'll call you back, if they'll call you back, and when they'll want you to go. So I've done it twice. I think the buzzer and I just don't like each other. You have to time that just exactly right to get through. So I haven't actually gotten to be on TV as much as I've wanted to.
Right. Now you've got this first book out of the way, are you thinking of writing a second book?
I have some ideas. Everybody's asked me. It's why I don't consider myself necessarily a writer. I consider myself a person with writing ability. The writers I've read about seem to have books bursting to get out of them. I have to sort of dig mine out, sort of like mining for gold, and I sort of have to hack through all of the rock and ore to get to the vein of gold. The book I was thinking of was maybe a short story collection dealing with my 12 years at a residential school for the blind in the mid to late 70s. It's something that you don't hear much about anymore. It was definitely a unique place and time that's basically all but gone.
Indeed, and a lot of you know, special schools for the blind, well, I guess they still are, but a lot of people just try and keep people in mainstream these
right,
days.
Right, and I think that's a good idea. In fact, during my high school years, we actually did some mainstreaming. It was sort of a weird way to do it. We mainstreamed from the school for the blind back into a public school in Baton Rouge. I actually went to 4 high schools, if you want to look at it that way. In 9th, 11th, and 12th grades, I attended a different high school each year, plus the School for the Blind. So I actually went to 4 high schools during my high school years. I think now you would just go to the high school in your hometown, and they would be able to accommodate you with Braille and have an itinerant teacher or a resource teacher work with you.
Exactly. Yeah, my first wife, she did that for the last 5 years. She worked at the school. She had a pupil who she sat with during a class and, you know, helped them with make the notes and made sure the Braille copies were there, etc., for him. So, and that was it. He was there in mainstream school.
Right. I think that's a very good way to be, because you're never separate. You're always with everybody. I had some friends who did that in New Orleans, but New Orleans was the exception in Louisiana at the time I was in school. Most people in Louisiana did not mainstream at that time, from grade 1 through grade 12. She told me they mostly participated in all of their classes, but for math, they had a resource teacher.
Right. Well, David, it's been fascinating talking to you, but time is going. So what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find out more about you and, of course, your book.
The best place to do that would be on the website that is maintained by the couple who edited my book for me. The website is dldbooks.com. That's the DLD stands for David and Lenore Dvorkin, who edited the book. It's dldbooks.com. And once you're there, that will bring you to the homepage. You can see the link to Across Two Novembers. Click that link, and you're going to see all of the information about the book, quotes from the book and about the book, and links to several interviews that I've done, and including one which was an excellent review, that was, because there were interviews and book reviews. One that I'm really proud of is by Deborah Kendrick, who is a noted blind journalist. She did a review that appeared in the September issue of Access World, which is a publication put out by an email by the American Foundation for the Blind, and she did it and said it was one of the most interesting books written by a blind person about life as a blind person that she had seen, and she apparently has read or encountered many such books. So that really meant something.
Indeed so. Indeed so. Well, it's been fascinating chatting with you, David. Thank you so much for being a guest. And if you get that other book out, please let me know and we'll come back and have you on the show again.
Great. And thank you for having me and everyone for listening.
My pleasure. Thank you. Well, there you go. My guest today, David Fauchx, and that's Fauchx, Fauchx, and his book, Across Two Novembers, basically it's 12 months, 12 or 13 if you count the two Novembers, A Year in the Life of a Blind Bibliophile. Great book, very interesting, lots of interesting bits through it, and, you know, explains the bits in the books, as he said, that he read during that time, and you can find him on the website of dldbooks.com, dldbooks.com. Very interesting indeed. Well, that's it for now. I'll be back again on Sunday, but until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget.